Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, March 18, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is off for the week. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. All right, so more health stuff. Let's see what's going on. I was supposed to have an MRI on February 23rd, but you know what happened on February 23rd. If you're in the Northeast, we had Snowmageddon. It was exciting. Nobody was going anywhere. There was a state of emergency called. And so I think it was Tuesday, the next day, I got the call from Radiology Associates of Hereford. And she said, okay, when would you like to come in instead? And we got my MRI reset up for the 11th of March. So when you're watching this, I've already had it, but I don't have the results back yet. And then I said to her, do you work on just the Glastonbury location or do you work on all of the locations? She said, all of them. And I said, oh my goodness, how many people do you have to reschedule? And she said, you don't want to know. So I said, oh, you poor thing. It's probably a lot because nobody could go anywhere. Nobody could get their radiology done on Monday, February 23rd, because snow. We had the biggest snowstorm we've had in a number of years. And I'm so envious. So many people have gotten to go out locally to Mansfield Hollow or Goodwin or other local fields, and they were able to snowshoe and cross-country ski, the rail trail, all kinds of places. And, you know, I'm not in a place where I'd be afraid to do that because my leg is just not right at the moment. It's not terrible, but it's not great. Anyway, so we're having all this snow. In the next little while, we had a couple of days of, we got into the 40s, and we're going to have some 50s this weekend, but then we're going to have a spate of colder weather and back to snow, mixed precipitation, rain and stuff. And it's going to be kind of wet because early March, what can I say? That's what we're looking into. So I still have femoral neuralgia discomfort. It's not through the roof. It's manageable, but it gets worse when I do anything extra, like when I do a lot of bike riding or if I do a lot of walking or if I do a lot of stretching. And it's very sad. One of the things I'm doing is I went to Crossroads and I had a couple of visits there and I was very impressed with them. So Crossroads Physical Therapy in Columbia, and I saw Tom and I saw Rory. And Tom did an initial assessment. He did a little bit of manual therapy that was very helpful. And he modified some exercises for me. Then I saw Rory and Rory said, some of your exercises I think you could still do, although I'm still holding off so he could consult with Tom. Rory did some very impressive integrative manipulative therapy and there was some energy work layered into that. And so I could feel energetic releases and emotional stuff. It was kind of good. So I'm going to go back and see Rory again in the next couple days, which is very good. So, and then I'm not going to have the MRI. The MRI was rescheduled for like 2.5 weeks after it was originally scheduled. And then I will see Tamika a week after that to find out what's going on, because I don't know if the results will dump into my chart. They might, because I did see in the Hartford Healthcare My Chart, because I have all the My Charts consolidated. I think that I saw that there was, you know, prep instructions for the My Chart for the MRI. And so there's some things that you're supposed to do right before the MRI. And that was in my Hartford Healthcare My Chart. So I have to look at that again. So I might get the results back before I see Tamika, and then I'll know what's going on. Anyway, I'm very concerned that I still have stenosis, and they're going to say something about more surgery, and I hope they don't say that. Of course, I don't have to have surgery. Stenosis can be managed conservatively. I guess it just depends on what's actually going on and what the degree of it is. I'm so afraid they're going to say you need a fusion, and fusion it's very painful and has a long recovery, and I just don't want to go there if I can avoid it. So that's what's going on with that. I had my second iridotomy done. So both of my eyes are now safe and I can get them dilated and cannabis is okay. And I'm finished with the eye drops. So that's good. I just have one more visit with Dr. Wong in New Britain to check the eyes to make sure that they're okay. And then I'm good. And then I can go back to the optometrist and get normal stuff done. And hopefully my eyes are generally okay. And then I have a temporary bridge in my mouth, and I'm going to get there's no such thing as a permanent bridge, but the less temporary bridge is going to happen later in the month. So that's going on too. And Ron is having some GI stuff, and we're monitoring him to see if he has a partial intestinal blockage. When it rains, it pours. And right now he's doing fine. We thought he had an acute gastroenteritis, and the acute symptoms are much, much better. He's eating now and he's been functioning and going to work and teaching and stuff. But we just have to monitor, because if he's not right, he has to go back to the ER and get taken care of. But for the moment, he's okay. So nothing to worry about at the moment. So we'll see. So that's what's going on, this, that, and the other thing. Let's hope that the big thing I'm hoping for is, first of all, I want Ron to be okay. And second of all, I'm hoping that I'm not going to need more surgery, or if I do need surgery, that it's going to be minimally invasive, or they'll have something to suggest to me that's minimally invasive. So anyway, that's what's going on. Okay. So, and then there's some prep that you have to do before you have an MRI with contrast. And let me see if I could find it here. It's, I didn't realize that there's some stuff that you have to take care of. Like, I don't know if there's, I think there's some prep you have to do. Like, I'm not sure if it's like you can't eat for 4 hours before you go. Here, new instructions for spine contrast with MRI with contrast. Complete as directed. Here's the comments. Okay. No, it's not. It's not telling me. All right. So. I don't see the instructions. I'm gonna have to look that up. Okay. So anyway, so let's get into some things. The other thing that's gonna happen is the next time you hear from me, I will have been to the CNPA conference, the Connecticut Naturopathic Physicians Association conference, and it's gonna be in Old Saybrook at a spa on the water. I'm going to stay at another spa in Westbrook that's 5 miles away. And I think the first night that I leave, I'm going to go stay with my friend Rob. And then the second night, I'll be overnight at the other spa in Westbrook. And then, so it's a two-day conference. So I get all my continuing ed. And as smart as I am, it's going to make me smarter. Conferences are exhausting. And you would think you're just sitting there listening to people. But you're listening to people trying to actively listen, glean information, get important stuff, type stuff up, and learn. And it's overwhelming. And then you go and see all the vendors and you talk to them about stuff, and you have to make decisions about what you're going to do with what you learned with your practice. And the other thing is, you know, you go to the vendors and they have all kinds of cool things to offer you, and you have to decide, hey, would this product help my patient? And so there's all kinds of decisions you have to make. So and you know, you have to do the continuing ed stuff, and then there will be a few lectures that the CEUs will only be available online, so you have to watch videos and then take quizzes. But if you go in person, there's only 3 or 4 of those. It's still a lot of work, you know, and it's tiring. So I'm going to be going to that conference and I'm going to learn stuff, and hopefully I'll learn some things that I can then share with you. Okay, so let's talk about some nuts. So first of all, I want to remind you that monounsaturated fats are good for you. What's a monounsaturated fat? Without going into what all the different kinds of saturations of fats are, monounsaturated means that you have a long-chain fatty acid that is only saturated at one site. It's only unsaturated at one site. So when you have omega-3 fatty acids, the first unsaturated site is at the third carbon. It's a long chain of carbons. They're attached together by hydrogens and oxygens, and mostly carbons in the beginning. And an omega-3 fatty acid has the first unsaturated chain. That means from the third carbon to the fourth carbon. That means that it's double bonded between two of the carbons. It's not so saturated, means that all of the carbons are either attached to another carbon or saturated with hydrogen. So carbon number 3, an omega-3 fatty acid, is the first carbon that is double bonded to the next carbon. And then usually omega-3s are polyunsaturated. So if you go along that chain, there's going to be more unsaturated parts. And that's, so omega-3 fatty acids are polyunsaturated. That means that they have a number of carbons attached to each other that are double bonded. That's what that means. A saturated fat has no double bonds at all. And omega-6 fatty acid has their first double bond at, guess what? The sixth carbon. And generally, omega-6 fatty acids are polyunsaturated, which means they have more unsaturated bonds than number 6. A monounsaturated fat has only one point of unsaturation. And generally, we're talking about oleic acid. Oleic acid is in nuts and seeds. It's in olives and olive oil and avocados. And it's in cocoa, you know, raw organic cocoa. And so a monounsaturated fat means that there is only one set of carbons that are double bonded to each other. And oleic acid, that double bond is at the ninth carbon. It's an omega-9 fatty acid. So monounsaturated fats are generally found in plants. I don't know if there are omega-9s in animal sources, but they're definitely in plants. And the big sources of omega-9 fatty acids are nuts and seeds, avocados and avocado oil, olives and olive oil, and cacao, you know, raw organic cocoa. That's where your omega-9s are. So monounsaturated fats are really good for, they're good for raising HDL, your high-density lipoprotein, which is the protein that carries cholesterol from the rest of your body back to your liver for processing. And it lowers triglycerides. Triglycerides are the first form that fat takes when it's being stored in your bloodstream. And so it lowers triglycerides. So triglycerides are more likely to get stored or used as opposed to running around in your bloodstream, potentially being oxidized and damaging your blood vessels. And monounsaturated fats, omega-9 fatty acids, also tend to lower LDL. So LDL is the low-density lipoprotein that carries cholesterol from your liver to the rest of your body for use. The other things that they do is they can puff up the size of your LDL. They can make your LDL increase in volume or increase in density, I should say. And so reduce in density. You want it low density, high volume of each LDL particle, can increase the number of LDL particles and also increase their size, lower their density. Okay, and when you have less dense LDL particles, again, they are less likely to get stuck in between your cells and cause atherosclerotic blockages. So monounsaturated fats are real good for that sort of thing. And so they raise HDL, they lower LDL, they lower triglycerides, they increase your LDL size and decrease your LDL particle number. And they also can decrease LDL oxidation. So the actual damage to LDL, it can decrease that as well. If you have high LDL, but it's not oxidized, it's probably okay. You're not going to have much in the way of atherosclerotic heart disease. So what can you eat? So I wanted to remind you that macadamia nuts, I read this about macadamia nuts. People think of macadamia nuts as being pretty fatty, and they are. And they are very tasty because they have a little more saturated fat in them than, say, an almond, because macadamia nuts sit in the sun. They're tropical nuts, so they sit in the sun and they cook more fats. So the fat gets cooked more, and so they're a little more saturated. But they are the nut that is highest in monounsaturates. So they're very good for helping you with cardiovascular disease. Any nut or seed that you eat is going to be high in fiber and it's going to be nutritious, have some protein and minerals in it. But macadamia nuts are the highest in monounsaturated fatty acids. So the next nut I wanted to talk about pistachios, because we were talking about Dubai chocolate, the Dubai chocolate craze last week. So now I wanted to talk about pistachios themselves and why they're so good for you. They are also high in monounsaturates. So here's the deal with pistachios. Here's a bunch of health benefits for pistachios. They're tasty, they're fun to eat, they're nutritious, and eating pistachios can be traced back nearly 300,000 years. So they're very nutritious. They have some carbs in them. They have a bunch of fiber in them. So when you're talking about 49 pistachios, it's a lot of pistachios, only has 159 calories, and 8 grams of carb, 3 grams of fiber, 6 grams of protein. That's not nothing. And, you know, a 159-calorie snack is not a bad thing, and you're getting a lot of nutrition for it. 13 grams of fat, which is mostly monounsaturated. It has potassium, phosphorus, B6, thiamine, copper, and manganese. So they're generally, in terms of foods, they're relatively high in vitamin B6. And vitamin B6 is good for all sorts of stuff. It's good for nerve function, and it's good for metabolizing serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter that you need for mood and emotion and digestive function. So vitamin B6 is super important. Vitamin B6 is also anti-inflammatory. It's something that helps with inflammation as well as pain. And I will give P5P, pyridoxal 5-phosphate, which is the methylated form of vitamin B6. It's more bioavailable to help with inflammation and pain. So pistachios are decent for potassium, and an ounce has more potassium than half a banana. So that's nice. They have a lot of antioxidants, so that antioxidants, of course, can protect cell damage and can play a key role in reducing risk of certain cancers. And they're a great source of antioxidants, and they have a higher amount of than other nuts and seeds because they're high in lutein and zeaxanthin. So lutein and zeaxanthin, you think of lutein and zeaxanthin as being in leaves, that they're high in kale. Well, they're high in pistachios too, and they're important antioxidants for your eye health. They help protect your eyes from damage that are caused by blue light and age-related macular degeneration. And so they're also high in polyphenols and tocopherols. So polyphenols are wonderful antioxidants. Tocopherols are the vitamin E-related compounds, great antioxidants, protective against cardiovascular and heart disease. They're not super high in calories, but they're high in protein. A lot of nuts tend to be high in calories, but you can eat 28 grams of pistachios for only 159 calories. And there's 185 in walnuts and 196 in pecans. Pecans are pretty fatty. Pecans are very delicious. I think pecans are a little higher in carbs. That's why they're sweet. But pistachios are not as high in calories. And 14% of their calorie content is protein. So they're second only to almonds when it comes to protein content. So almonds, if you want the highest protein nut, you're looking at almonds. Pistachios are also rich in essential amino acids, which may be obtained through diet because your body can't make them. Pistachios may help you with weight loss. MUFAs can help with weight loss, so pistachios are high in those, and they also have the fiber and protein, which helps you to feel full. There were studies that showed that regular consumption of pistachios may be linked to a reduction in body mass index, which is used to estimate body fat, but so your BMI could go down, but they're not associated with change in body weight or belly fat. There was another study who found that people who ate pistachios had reductions in blood pressure, ate fewer sweets, increased their fiber intake, which helps you with weight loss. And pistachio fat content may not be fully absorbed. That's not just true of pistachios. That's true of pretty much any nut. I also mean peanuts. Peanuts are not a nut. They're technically a legume. Remember that when you're talking about the calorie of a food, when you're talking about the calories in food, you're not talking about the actual calories that are in the food. You're talking about what would happen, the amount of energy it would take to take that food and burn that calorie to ash. That's how calories are measured. How they actually function in your body is going to be fairly individual because it depends on how much you absorb of them. And a lot of times when you eat nuts and seeds, even though they have a lot of fat in them, they also have a lot of fiber in them. And the fiber is going to escort a significant portion of that fat out. So if you ate the same calories of pistachios versus the same calories of donut, you're going to have more effective calories in the donut than you are in the pistachios, because the pistachios have so much fiber. Fiber is going to help to escort some of the caloric elements of those pistachios out. Fiber tends to do that in general. Fiber tends to effectively lower the true calories of a food. So that's good to think about, that eating a high fiber diet is a very good idea if you're trying to lose fat. You can eat more food, and you could eat the same number of calories of food when you eat whole foods that have fiber and healthy fat in them and protein than as if you did if you were eating a lot of starchy food and sugary food. You can eat the same number of calories and lose weight, whereas if you ate the sugary and starchy food, you'd probably gain weight. Just because the effective calories are different. So it's true that when you eat the pistachios, not all of the fat is absorbed. But I'm telling you that that's true of nuts and seeds in general. So in-shell pistachios are good for mindful eating because you have to take the time to shell them. And so it slows your eating time. Anything that slows your eating time is going to slow your satiety. That means you're going to be full sooner the slower you eat. So when you eat in-shell pistachios, again, this is true about the in-shell pistachios were studied, but if you had a bowl of nuts that were in the shell and you had to crack each one, you're going to get full sooner than if you were eating just some mixed nuts that were already shelled, because you can't just pop them one by one. You have to crack the nut and then eat it. And then you're like done after a while, because there's a feedback loop. The faster you eat, the feedback loop for satiety takes time. And the slower that you eat, the more full you will feel for that particular meal. If you ate the same meal in 5 minutes versus 20 minutes, that 20-minute meal is going to make you feel more full. So when you eat nuts and seeds in shells and you have to crack them open, you have to take the time to do that. And that slows down how fast you can eat them, which is going to make you full sooner. So you're going to wind up eating less. Cool, huh? Pistachios are high in fiber. A serving has 3 grams, which is a decent amount of fiber. And, you know, that helps you on your goal of the recommendation for most people for fiber is 25 to 30 grams a day. If you have diverticulosis and you want to eat enough fiber to keep things moving through, at least 25 grams is what you want to do. That's hard to do if you're not used to it. I'm kind of used to it because I eat a lot of fiber throughout the day between fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and oats and other whole grains. And I get a lot of fiber in, but not everybody does that. And you have to season your belly to get to be able to do that, because you can't break down cell walls. And if you're eating a lot of plant foods, they have cell walls. And so how you break down cell walls is we're humans, we're mammals. We do not, well, not that we're mammals. We are not ruminants. So we do not have cellulase in our systems. Actually, ruminants have cellulase and other herbivores have cellulase. So a rabbit will have cellulase enzyme in their digestive systems. We do not. So in order to get into fruits and vegetables, they have to be warmed up. They have to be agitated. They have to be pureed or they have to be cooked. They have to have stuff on them that makes the stuff more bioavailable. We have to chew them up real good. Or we have to take enzymes. And the other way to do it is when you regularly eat a lot of plant foods, it changes your microbiome. Your microbiome, the proportion of bacteria that are in your digestive system, changes with what you eat. And, you know, there are studies that are done on tribal people where they check their stool and find that their winter diet gives them a different microbiome than their summer diet. That's going to be true of you too. If you eat a whole bunch of, you know, this diet and then you completely change it, you're going to have a different microbiome. Well, your microbiome can help you digest your food. So the microbiome is going to feed on the cellulase and break it open. And so the more healthful microbiome you have, the more able you're going to be able to digest your plant foods and not suffer from gas and bloating and digestive discomfort. So don't be surprised if you've been eating 5 grams of fiber a day and you suddenly go to 20 grams. if you get gas and bloating, because your microbiome is not set up to do that. If you're going to do that, you might want to gradually increase your fiber. Also consider taking enzymes that contain cellulase or hemicellulase in it, and also taking a probiotic. And the probiotic, those things are going to help you digest your plant foods more. So fiber moves through your digestive system, mostly undigested, and some types of fiber are digested by the good bacteria in your gut, and that makes them prebiotics. So gut bacteria ferment the fiber and convert it into short-chain fatty acids. And short-chain fatty acids can benefit you by reducing your risk of digestive disorders, cancer, and heart disease. And butyrate is probably the most beneficial of the short-chain fatty acids. And when you eat pistachios, you increase your number of butyrate-producing bacteria in the gut to a greater extent than when you eat almonds. So pistachios have some particular interesting things that are good for you. Cholesterol and blood pressure. Pistachios can reduce your risk of heart disease in a number of ways. They can help lower blood cholesterol and improve blood pressure. There's studies on pistachios and blood lipids that involve placing part of the calories in a diet with pistachios. About 67% of the studies found reductions in total LDL and increases in HDL. And none of the studies observed that eating pistachios harmed your lipid profile. They can also lower blood pressure more than other. And I should be eating more pistachios. Okay, I'm going to start. There were 21 studies that found that eating pistachios reduced your systolic blood pressure. That's the top number, the pressure that it takes to push blood to your entire body, by 1.82 millimeters of mercury, and decreased diastolic blood pressure by 0.8 millimeters. That doesn't seem very high, but maybe it's enough to make a difference. All right. And pistachios can also protect blood vessel health. So they are endothelium enhancers. So the endothelium is the lining of the inside of your blood vessels. So you want to have your endothelium working properly. Endothelial dysfunction is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Vasodilation is when your blood vessels dilate. And when your endothelium is dysfunctional, it's characterized by reduced vasodilation, which will lead to less blood flow and increased blood pressure. Nitric oxide is a compound that plays an important role in vasodilation, causing blood vessels to dilate by signaling the smooth cells in the endothelium to relax. So like most nuts, pistachios are a source of the amino acid L-arginine, which gets converted to nitric oxide in the body. So they can play an important role in blood vessel health. You need proper blood flow for many bodily functions, including erectile function. Regular consumption of nuts, including pistachios, was associated with improvements in sexual desire and orgasmic function in males. So that's interesting too. So endothelial function, you want to have good endothelial function, which has to do with the widening, the vasodilation of your blood vessels. The more relaxed and wide your blood vessels are, the lower the pressure going through is. Think about, shooting a liquid like a soda through a straw. If it's a tiny skinny straw, it's going to come out a lot faster than if it's a very wide straw. And if you suck through a straw, likewise, you're going to get more fluid in at a lower pressure, the wider it is. And the same thing holds for restrictions on a creek or lack of restrictions thereof. You'll see more rapids or more rapidly flowing creek if it's skinny and there's a lot of water going through. And if the same amount of water is going through and it's wide, then it's going to be nice and calm and happy. So endothelial function is very important. So remember that nuts and seeds in general are high in arginine. And if you have herpes, or if you're having a herpes flare, whether it's upstairs or downstairs, herpes viruses love L-arginine. So I don't tell people to not eat nuts and seeds, except if they're in a flare, then I might tell them not to, because the L-arginine can feed herpes viruses. But if you haven't had a flare in a very long time, I would go ahead and eat the nuts and seeds. If every time you eat almonds, you get a herpes flare, then I wouldn't eat them. It depends what's going on. But most people who get herpes, they get herpes flares, whether it's cold sores or genital herpes. They can eat nuts and seeds as long as they're not having a flare. You just avoid them when you are. And then you increase your lysine, and because lysine can suppress the activity of arginine that increases the viral load. All right. So pistachios can help lower blood sugar, even though they have a higher carb content than a lot of nuts. They still have a low glycemic index, which means they don't cause a lot of blood sugar spikes. Research shows that eating pistachios can help blood sugar regulation. There was a study that showed that pistachios could significantly reduce fasting blood sugar and improve your insulin resistance in people with type 2 diabetes or prediabetes or even metabolic syndrome. So there was a study in 2024 that found that if you ate 57 grams of pistachios after dinner, it could be a great nighttime snack if you have prediabetes. If you eat them between dinner and bedtime, they have similar effects on glycemic, lipid, and blood sugar levels as traditional care. That would you rather eat a pistachio or take a jug? Pistachios are really delicious, so might be nice to have. They're full of antioxidants, carotenoids, phenolics, all beneficial for blood sugar regulation. They are delicious and fun to eat. You can eat them by themselves. You can throw them on pizzas. I never thought of that. They'd be great in salads. You can crunch them and put them on fish. You can, of course, there's no end of desserts. And of course, we have the famous Dubai chocolate. And using them in baking, like in cheesecake. And you can use them as one of the nuts you use in pesto. And you can get pistachio butter, too. There's not a recommended daily dosage of pistachios, but if you have 49 of them, you're going to get about 159 calories, and it's a relatively low-calorie snack, and you're going to get a lot of those health benefits. They can have antioxidant, anti-inflammatory properties. They can contribute to brain and gut health while improving your blood lipid markers and help you reduce the risk of developing chronic conditions like obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. They may help reduce your BMI, which is an estimation of total body fat, but not necessarily belly fat. They're a great source of fats, fiber, protein, antioxidants, and nutrients, including B6 and B1. And they may help you with weight loss, lower your cholesterol, blood sugar, improve your gut and eye health. And they're easy and fun to eat. So that's the deal with pistachios. So why should you eat that lovely nut that made the Dubai chocolate? That's why. All right, now we're going to talk about sleep. We are going to talk about why you don't sleep as well as you get older, which I understand because I don't sleep as well as I get older. So that's and something I hear from all my patients. What can I do for sleep? So last year being when this article was written, For the first time, older adults got their very own sleep recommendations. The National Sleep Foundation concluded after reviewing scientific research on sleep duration that adults ages 65 and up should aim for 7 to 8 hours a night, compared with adults 26 to 64 who should sleep between 7 and 9. Well, I haven't hit 64 yet, so I guess I need to sleep closer to 9. I feel better the closer to 9 that I get. It may not be a huge deal at first, but many older adults inherently know that sleep really does change with age. Your sleep changes through your lifespan, and some of the most dramatic changes occur in your early 20s or in your 20s. But as you reach older adulthood, some themes arise. Many sleepers over 50 find it's easier to become awakened during the night. Yep, which is reflected in a little shorter sleep duration overall. And it's not a welcome change because about 71% of 55 to 64-year-olds, that's me, report some sleep problem, including difficulty falling asleep, waking up still tired, yep, and snoring. I win. Dowdovich urges anyone dealing with these issues to bring them up with a medical professional. Depending on the symptoms, you could be excessively sleepy during the day, or you could be irritable or unfocused and even achy. Medication, lifestyle change, and cognitive therapies can help. So one of the things that happens is your bedtime and your wake-up time shift earlier. Definitely true. I need to go to bed earlier. I used to be able to stay up at 1 in the morning and still be pretty good at 7 or 8 in the morning. Now that's not true at all. It used to be all you wanted to do when you were 19 was stay up late and doze until noon. So it's not just because you're lazy, it's because your natural internal clocks, our circadian rhythms, are delayed until our 20s, meaning we truly don't get tired until later at night and don't feel alert till later in the morning. After we grow out of this phase, though, our circadian rhythms keep advancing, and later in life, we tend to become sleepy earlier and feel our most alert earlier in the morning, too. As you get older, you wake up more during the night, and I definitely do. And so in our brains, as we age, the amplitude of our brain waves changes. To be classified as deep, restful, restorative sleep, brain waves have to reach a certain height, and after age 50 or so, the spikes just don't get as high. That lighter sleep is a heck of a lot easier to disturb, meaning you become a lot easier to wake up in the middle of the night. And whether your partner is snoring, the house is creaking, you have a little indigestion, you have to go to the bathroom, you're thirsty, that's what happens to me, you find you're no longer able to sleep through disturbances, and those arousals in turn mean you're getting worse sleep. Of course, it's only natural to figure you can make up for that with an afternoon nap, but while you're undoubtedly tired during the day if you've tossed and turned all night, napping sometimes can do more harm than good, which can also disrupt your natural sleep rhythms. So some 53% of adults aged 55 to 84 get up to pee every night or almost every night. Certainly some of us get a more frequent urge to relieve ourselves as we age, possibly because our nerves don't function as well. And it may also simply be related to lighter sleep. People are more aware of urges to urinate that they may not have been aware of when they were in deeper sleep. As long as you can fall back to sleep within 5 or 10 minutes of a pee break, it's okay. And if it's difficult to doze off again after a trip to the bathroom, then you have to talk to your doctor. Then there's menopause. Yay, menopause. The menopause gives you hormonal wackiness. That's a technical term. It can definitely disrupt your slumber. When your estrogen and progesterone fluctuate, it can make healthy sleep harder to come by, and hot flashes can wake you up or make it impossible to drift off. Mood changes can also trigger your sleep problems, making menopause unfriendly to sleep. Aside from following general sleep hygiene rules, you might also want to make your environment more flexible if you can. Sleep in breathable fabrics, layer sheets and blankets so you can fling them to the side when you feel hot. One of aging's more unpleasant side effects is how easy it is to suddenly find yourself carrying a bit of extra poundage. The weight can make you snore, so carrying extra weight can make you snore, especially if it's on your abdomen. If your windpipe narrows so much that it becomes blocked, you may even stop breathing periodically, which is known as obstructive sleep apnea. While sleep apnea is more common in men, after menopause, more women start to experience it. So if you're snoring or have apnea, you don't get as much oxygen, which changes the overall quality of your sleep. And you're probably also bothering the person lying next to you. If you sleep next to a snoring bed partner, you lose about an hour of sleep a night. Oh no, hence the sleep divorce. As you get older, you're more at risk for getting restless legs. So that sleep-related condition starts to climb after you hit 50 or so, and that urge to move, usually your legs, can also grow more severe with age. There's a lot that experts don't understand about restless legs. It's thought to be related to the brain chemical dopamine, which declines with age, or because you have an iron deficiency, which is often common with older folks. So somebody has restless legs. Iron is one of the things that I screen. If any of my patients come in, if their iron hasn't been checked, I check it. And they're like, but I'm not anemic. This has nothing to do with anemia. You may be iron deficient and not be anemic. So one of the things you do is you measure the ferritin, which is the iron stores, and also the serum iron. So you might have a decent serum iron, but if your stores, the reference range for ferritin is very big. In women, it's something, depending on the lab, it's somewhere between 10 and 15. 10 and 15, I can't remember what the units are. Up to the 200s, and for men, it's even higher. And so if somebody has restless legs and their ferritin is in the low end of that range, so even if it's within the range, but say the reference range is 10 and they're at 20, I will probably give them some iron to take. But because that extra iron can help keep your legs calmer. If you have restless legs and your ferritin is in the low end of normal, I'm going to give you iron supplements. If you're iron deficient, then absolutely. If your iron is in the higher end of the range, then I'm not going to be giving you iron, but you might be less inclined to have the restless legs. I also For restless legs, I will also give magnesium and check magnesium and folic acid. Those are things that I will offer. And I will give iron to men if their ferritin is low enough or if they're iron deficient. So those are some sleep-related changes that happen as you age. That's kind of interesting. So, you know, talk to me about what's going on with your sleep, and I will help you with those different factors. So here's some ways to get better sleep. Let's see. So here's some 20 tips for getting better sleep. So to get sound sleep, sleep can turn into anything. So God bless Beth, my girlfriend who is in heaven. And I remember saying to me that good sleep turns into anything. Something she said that she said a lot of things that I will never forget, but that was one of them. Turns into anything. It turns into more productivity. It turns into a better bike ride. It turns into a better time at work. It turns into a more peaceful interaction with a loved one. It turns into anything that you want to accomplish is going to be better with sleep. There was an ad, I don't know if it was an Olympic ad, but it was an athlete who was saying, he was showing you how he was doing all these great tricks. He says, the best performance over here, and he's pointing to himself on a snowboard or whatever, starts here, and he pointed to his bed. So the best anything starts in the bed, and not just with intimacy, but with just good old sleeping. So when you sleep soundly, it results in increased energy, productivity, good heart and immune health, a better mood, longer life, and you just feel so much better after satisfying 8 hours of rest. Most people aren't getting it, though. Women tend to get less sleep overall than men do, and even if you don't have children, levels of sleep-promoting estrogen sink regularly during menstruation and then permanently in menopause. Yay. And symptoms related to both cramps, headaches, hot flashes, night sweats also disrupt slumber. And so experts agree that those biological factors don't mean that sleep deprivation has to be your destiny. If you feel tired, that shouldn't be considered normal. But there are no stock sleep solutions either. So that's why when I give people a list of things to do to sleep better, it's a long list. And you have to try all these different things to help. And it may not be one thing. It may be a bunch of things. So finding out what works for you may take some trial and error. And my patients want me to give them a pill. And pills can help, but they are not the main thing. The main thing that helps with sleep is generally lifestyle stuff. So it's important to work out what the lifestyle things are. Here's some things that are listed up to be helpful. So one of the things to do is set a sleep schedule and stick to it. That means go to bed the same time every night and get up at the same time every morning, even on the weekends. When you have a regular sleep routine, it keeps your biological clock steady and you rest better. You also expose yourself to a regular pattern of light and dark, which is harder to do if you don't live at the equator or in the tropics. Because in the tropics, at the equator, the day length doesn't change very much. Once you start getting, the further north you get, so here we are at not quite the 42nd parallel where I am in Connecticut. We're at about 41.8 or so, 42. The 42nd parallel is in Massachusetts and, you know, other states going across. But anyway, it's definitely in Massachusetts. Halfway between the equator and the North Pole is the 45th parallel. That's a little north of Salem, Oregon. And it is on this coast, it goes through Maine, Nova Scotia. Did you know that Halifax, Nova Scotia is south of Portland, Oregon? Portland, Oregon is at 45 and change. And Seattle is at like 46. And St. John's, Newfoundland is only slightly north of Seattle. It's like St. John's, Newfoundland is only like 46, 47 parallel. So people think it's so far north. It's not. It's not even as far north as London. London is in the 50s. And the Arctic Circle is 60. People think Newfoundland is way far north. Well, it's north of here. But parallel, you know, latitude-wise, it's not that far up. It's, like I said, it's even with Washington State. People don't realize how far north Washington State actually is. At Oregon and Washington, they're even with Atlantic Canada. And Maine is pretty far north because the 45th parallel does go through Maine. Anyway, so my point is that when you live at the latitude that we're at, So wherever you're listening, if you're listening locally, you know, we're at the 41 and changeth parallel. And if you're listening to Massachusetts, you're a little bit further north of that. And you could be listening in Israel. I do have people who listen all over the world. Thank you very much. Anyway, depending how far north you are, your day length varies a lot between the winter and the summer. And you're always having to adjust to that. And in fact, a lot of people don't feel well in the spring and the fall. And we notice that homeopathically when we're studying archetypes. People don't feel well in those changes of seasons because you're at a rate of rapidly increasing light. Right now we're at a rate of rapidly increasing light. And in October, November, we're at a rate of rapidly declining light. And your body, the light level is changing faster than your body can adjust to it. And that's happening right now. It's because it's, depending when you're listening to this, it's February, March. So we're getting more and more light. And as I'm recording this, we have not gone into daylight savings time, but that's going to happen not this weekend, but I believe next weekend. Well, although from when I'm recording this. So the changing light level affects your circadian cycle. So when they say go to bed the same time every night, that's a little hard because the light levels are changing. And I know that it's harder for me to stay, especially at this age, it's harder for me to stay asleep when it's light out. So I do things like I cover my face with plushy toys and with blankets so I can sleep a bit longer. It's harder to stay asleep when the sun has risen. And, you know, I can't always manage to get to bed at 10 o'clock. You know, my needed bedtime is probably somewhere in the 10 o'clock hour at this point. And I don't always do that because I'm wired after a long day. And so I'm getting to bed after 11. I'm always like, if I've start TV on and I'm watching the Gilmore Girls, I stayed up too late. So anyway, but if it's still better to get in bed at the same time every night and get up at the same time every morning, even though you have light issues. Because you're probably not going to adjust your bedtime and wake time to what the light is doing unless you have the luxury of doing that. I think that people who don't have to be somewhere at a certain time, because my start time of my work doesn't change. But the light does. The light level changes. So that makes it hard. And I'm at a point where I can get up in the 8 o'clock hour. And by 8 o'clock all year, it's light out. So that makes it easier for me. What changes for me is the time I'm awake in the evening. You have this super early sunset in the wintertime. But getting up in the morning, you know, it's by the time I have to be up, it's light out. And that, so when the sun rises at 5:30 and I need to sleep more, that makes it hard to do. And it's the other thing that happens, of course, is I live in the woods. So we have these birds the birds are coming out now. They're starting to sing a lot. And the birds will wake you up because the birds, they start singing at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. So it's the best you can do, the exposure to a good level of the same level of light and dark every morning, that's going to help you to sleep better. If you want to, you can keep a sleep diary to figure out how your habits affect your rest. You can track your sleep every day for about 2 weeks. Write down not only what's sleep-related, what time you go to bed, how long it takes you to fall asleep, how many times you wake during the night, and how you feel in the morning, but factors like what you ate close to bedtime and what exercise you got. If you compare your daily activities with your nightly sleep patterns, that can show you where you need to make sleep changes. You can go to sleepdoctor.com and get a sleep diary. I wonder if you can get a sleep diary, if you can order a sleep diary online. Sleep diary. Let's see if you can get one. Yep, you bet. Sleep log. So you can buy sleep log books. You can go to your favorite website and order sleep diaries. If you smoke, you shouldn't smoke. Smoking is a stimulant. It can make you less sleepy. Nicotine is a stimulant and prevents you from falling asleep. And many smokers experience withdrawal pangs at night. And smokers are 4 times more likely not to feel as well rested after a night's sleep than non-smokers. And smoking exacerbates sleep apnea and other breathing disorders. which can also stop you from getting a good night's rest. So don't worry that quitting will keep you up nights too. The effect passes in about 3 nights. That's it. So if you're having trouble sleeping and you want to quit smoking and you're really determined you're going to go cold turkey and just stop smoking, do it over a few days when you don't have to work, and just deal with the extra rest that you need during the day. Beta blockers, which are prescribed for high blood pressure, can cause insomnia. So can SSRIs. That's like your fluoxetine, your Zoloft, and your Prozac, and other antidepressants. And so drugs and supplements can affect sleep also. So if you're coming to me, make sure you tell me all the meds you're taking, because they can all affect sleep. So get exercise, but not within 4 hours of bedtime. So working out, especially cardio, improves the length and quality of your sleep, but don't do vigorous activity before bed because it keeps your body temperature elevated. When your body begins to cool down, it signals your brain to release sleep-inducing melatonin, and then you'll get drowsy. So it doesn't mean you don't have to not exercise at all. Doing yin or restorative yoga, something that involves being very still and breathing deeply and doing gentle stretching, that's okay. But doing a vigorous activity within 4 hours of bedtime is not a great idea. Maybe 10 years ago, when I was training for triathlons, which I'm not doing anymore, I went to a master swim class where they would teach us how to improve our strokes. And the class was late. It was at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And I didn't make it a lot because I had to leave work and I wouldn't be able to finish my work. But when I did go, I would be working out that time of night. I think I slept okay, but then I was a younger woman. I was not, you know, in my 60s. But anyway, I don't recommend doing vigorous physical activity. So I do Zwift, which is this online cycling platform. And there are people who do Zwift workouts many hours of the day and various hours of the day, because there are people all over the world doing Zwift. So while it's morning here, your friends in the UK, it's afternoon and even evening sometimes. So there's always somebody to work out with somewhere in the world. If you want to work out with your Aussie friends, your Aussie friends are 12, 13 hours away from you. So if you're, if you're working out at noon, it's the middle of the night there. So you're probably not going to be working out with them. But first thing in the morning, it's nighttime for them. But anyway, there's somebody anywhere for you to work out with. So really, it's better to do your very active workouts early in the day. And when I go for bike rides, I like to do my bike rides in the morning, maybe as late as into the afternoon, but I don't like to start in the afternoon. Cut your caffeine at 2 p.m. unless you're one of those lucky people who can drink caffeine and go to sleep. That would not be me. But coffee, tea, cola, it's a stimulant that stays in your system for about 8 hours. Now, they're saying 8 hours. That depends on the person. If you are a fast metabolizer, that may not be true. But for somebody like me, it's probably true. I am not a fast metabolizer. So you have to realize that count backwards from when you want to go to sleep. And if you want to be asleep by 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock is your cutoff time. And that's what this is suggesting. And if you want to go to sleep by 9 o'clock, it's 1 o'clock. So a lot of people, when they do caffeine, they try to keep it to the morning, which is a good practice. But sometimes your friend wants to meet you for coffee in the afternoon, and then you wind up having caffeine then. You're not going to sleep as well. Write down your woes. People can't turn off their minds. I have so many people who tell me that. To quiet your wakeful worrying, jot down your top concerns, like I have to call my insurer, I have to change my doctor's appointment, I have to go to this doctor's appointment and I'm worried about it. So try to make a plan to solve the problem and jot down the plan, and then let the paper worry about the plan instead of thinking about what you're going to do. So get the problem planned, and I usually feel better if I make a plan to solve a problem, and then I can let the problem go for a little bit. So action plans are a way to reduce worry about a certain thing, and then you may not be thinking about it as much. You also want to take time to wind down. Sleep is not an on-off switch. You have to slowly ease your foot off the gas. You need time to transition from your active day to bedtime drowsiness. So you want to prep for the next day. Make sure you prep for the next day earlier. Make sure your clothes are out and your bag is set up, that sort of thing. Take care of your personal hygiene, moisturize your face, brush your teeth, whatever you're going to do. And the last 20 nights, so if you're going to go to sleep at 10 o'clock, be in bed by 9:30, relaxing. Read a book, relax in bed, and practice deep breathing. Turn off your tech. Because tech is very stimulating. I'm being very stimulated by that. I have a phone and a laptop and one tablet and two tablets. So I have four tech right here. But fortunately, I'm going to go to bed in a few hours, so I'll probably be okay by then. And alcohol, a few hours after you drink alcohol, when the alcohol levels in your body start to drop, your body tends to wake up from it. And so an average person takes about an hour to metabolize a drink. So you have two glasses of wine with dinner, finish your last sips a couple hours before bed. All right, snack on cheese. This is the last one I'm going to read right now because it's almost time to wrap up. Snack on cheese and crackers. So cheese and crackers combines carbs with calcium and protein. And if you're not dairy intolerant, cheese has tryptophan in it, which helps you to boost serotonin and will help you sleep better. And have that snack about an hour before bedtime so the amino acids will reach your brain. So it's some kind of carbs and protein, especially if you are not dairy intolerant, cheese is great. And you could also do yogurt if you wanted to. And when I would visit Britain, they would have breakfast, dinner, and tea, and then they might have supper, and supper was usually cheese and fruit, and that was the first time I'd ever had an apple with cheese, and it was wonderful. So fruit and cheese can be a really good pairing, and I would probably better do the fruit than even the grainy stuff, but if you have whole grain toast or a whole grain cracker, that's probably okay. You could also do other carbs plus protein slash fat, like a banana with peanut butter or an apple with peanut butter. You could have a little cereal and milk. You could have fruit and low-fat yogurt, and that's going to be better for you than if you ate sugar. So I am going to let you go because that's all I have time for, and we're going to finish more great sleep tips next week, the next time I talk to you, unless I decide to put that off to after I tell you about what happened at the CNPA conference. All right, so I'm going to let you go. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Sorcendi, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Sorcendi. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores and WHUS.org.